Stratton, Rush Chairman. Damn glad to meet you.
Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books. And I'm joined by Tim Matheson. He is a Hollywood actor. Well, as an actor, I guess he lives in Hollywood area. He's you might remember him from such things as National Lampoon's Animal House, Fletch, West Wing, but he's done it all, and his new book is called Damn Glad to Meet You, My 7 Decades in the Hollywood Trenches. It is available everywhere. It's just a fine memoir. And Tim, I thought about this as I read your book last weekend. For somebody who's done this for as many decades as you, I can't imagine that anybody who's worked that long in a job remembers everything. So without IMDb, could you have gone back through your career and had such vivid memories of all of these things that you've been in, all of these different roles you've played? Because it doesn't seem like somebody that's done that would have that ability.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are certain things that are more memorable than others. And but, you know, once I started doing the research, and IMDb is a great tool, but also photographs from, you know, that I took. I used to shoot Polaroid pictures on the set all the time, and so I collected those, so you have a hard copy, nowadays you have iPhones and things, so that jogs your memory pretty much, so that helps a lot.
As I look back and read, something I found interesting is your relationship with Lucille Ball and how she inspired you comedy timing-wise, and there's a story that you told about the scene that you filmed with Dean Wormer's wife in Animal House. Can you explain how Lucille Ball spoke to you during the filming of that scene?
Yes, you know, the biggest lesson I learned from Lucy, one of many she taught me, was in the middle of a scene we were doing for Years, Mine, and Hours with 10 kids. We were making breakfast, and there's a prop guy under the sink hopping up toast out of a toaster on a certain line, and Lucy catches in the air, and it's one of those just rapid-fire scenes that got dialogue and blah, blah, you know, and physical action and pouring juice and, you know, all sorts of things. And in the middle of it all, when it wasn't going well with the kids and stuff, she looked at all of us and she said, "Always rehearse with your broth." And I was like, wow. She was all business when she was on the set. And what she meant was, pick up the plate, use the real thing, don't mime it, don't pretend. So, you know, and then you'll be in shape to do it on the take, and you won't be thinking about what you're supposed to be doing. And she always just said, trust your instincts, and you know. But what she meant is, if you're going to be funny, if you're going to be like a comedian in a comic, physical comedy scene, you have to know exactly how everything is going to work, when it's going to work. And, you know, these people came from vaudeville, where they're doing 8 shows a day. So when I got to the Dean Wormer scene, Mrs. Wormer scene, and where I invite her up to my room, and it's like a Playboy penthouse kind of place, the bar, and I'm acting all suave and debonair, I think, and one thing after the other starts to go wrong during the take, and I just went with it, because Lucy would never cut if something changed and you know, happened that wasn't in the script. She'd just go with it, and then she could say, "We'll always do it again later," but she rarely, if ever, broke up and said, "No, cut, it's no good, it's no good." So we walk in, and I've got a tie on, and I help Mrs. Wormer with her coat, and I take her coat off, and I put it in the hanger in a very debonair manner, and I reach over and try to hang it on the coat rack, but I missed it, and it fell on the floor, and I went, oh. And that wasn't planned, but it was like, okay, keep going. It was like she was in my ear going, oh, yeah, keep going. So, and then I just suavely loosen my tie, which is the only thing I'm wearing on my, except for a toga and a watch, which I thought was funny. And then I'm fixing her a drink, and I grab some ice cubes, and I want to keep my eye on her, so I throw the ice cube in the glass, and it bounces out. And I kind of went, oh, well. And then I grab another ice cube and throw it in the glass, and I think that one bounced out, too. And it was just those accidents, those sort of lucky accidents that Lucy always embraced. And it was a lesson for me, don't cut if something goes wrong. Just use it and build on it and keep going. And that's by having rehearsed that in my head 100 times, that allowed me to do that in that scene. And I think that's the take we used. I think we shot it one take, and that was that, you know.
Right. And you also, working with the folks from Lampoon, you had the opportunity to work with Doug Kenny, who was just a brilliant comic mind. And I didn't realize how close your relationship was to him, and where you were in Hawaii with him actually about a week before his death. But your relationship with Lampoon, I know you ended up owning part of the company toward the very end there, but with Lampoon, was that something that was always sort of the drumbeat of your career, or it was always in the back of your mind to get involved or stay involved with Lampoon?
I loved the National Lampoon. I missed the National Lampoon. It was the voice of outrage, and the bigger the target, the harder they hit something. You know, the sexism and racism, and in doing that, they made fun of it. Oftentimes, crossed the line, but they were the voice of my generation of humor. And so I was, they put their famous cover of a dog glancing off to the side at a cocked pistol at his head saying, if you don't buy this magazine, we'll shoot this dog. And it's like, it gets your attention in a very inappropriate but funny way. And one of the ways that we handled in the movie the sexism, racism, and just the poking fun at that it was set in 1962, but we shot it in 1977, it came out in 78. So you're looking back 15 years, and it's their way of saying, well, this isn't the way we are now. That's the way it was then. And so they give you the freedom to laugh at the guys going to the Dexter Lake Club, all these little white kids from college thinking they're so hip and cool and walking into an all-black club and going, oh, Otis loves us. And Otter goes, we are going to die. I mean, it's poking fun at something that was a sort of taboo, but it's just sort of also smartly done. And that was Doug Kenny. And Doug Kenny, who created the National Lampoon, would always walk that line. Sometimes you go over the line, sometimes you walk right up to it, but it was always funny.
I'm chatting with Tim Matheson about his new memoir, Damn Glad to Meet You, My 7 Decades in the Hollywood Trenches. It's available everywhere. Tim, you say Hollywood Trenches, and it wasn't until I was well into my adulthood that I realized that everybody that works in Hollywood is not a Leo DiCaprio, is not a Tom Cruise. There's a lot of hardworking, I would call them blue-collar actors, who are just in a ton of stuff, and they always keep working. And there were a lot of times in your career that you were paycheck to paycheck, and if you didn't get a role, you weren't going to keep your lights on. So you've maintained that for a while, but can you explain how that's sort of easier said than done? Because it's not apparent, I don't think, to everybody that thinks of Hollywood actors.
Yeah, because, every job you do, you think it's the last. It could be the last job. The phone may never ring again. You may never get another audition, especially when you're first starting out, And I was a kid actor, so I lived at home, so that was sort of okay. I mean, I didn't have to pay the rent, but I threw money into the pot for my mom and my sister, and that was the joy of making money at an early age. And then when that sort of part of my career ended, I got into a more lucrative part of it, which was doing cartoon voice work. I mean, that was... that I could make a living doing that because those artists, and they were really vocal artists. I was lucky enough to do a couple of different voices, for Hanna-Barbera, but guys like Doss Butler and Don Messick and Mel Blanc and June Foray and Janet Waldo and Marvin Miller, they were stars, and they went from recording session to recording session all day long, and they were the voices that we all heard and knew from television and in every cartoon show, and that was very, very well-paying. And then I transitioned from that into being a contract actor at Universal. I was one of the last people under contract, and that I could make a living doing, and I knew I'd get paid every week whether I worked or not, and so I was fortunate enough, but there were those times, and thank God for the Screen Actors Guild, because they gave us residuals when they reused or reran episodes of television that we had acted in and or done the voice work for, and that gave you the money to get by when you weren't working, or we got unemployment insurance. And me at 15 or 16 years old, standing in line with adults, you know, collecting my unemployment insurance, that was kind of hard to explain why I was there.
Your role on the West Wing as Vice President John Hoynes, the story in your book, how the role came about with you chatting with Rob Lowe and then eventually with right. Aaron Sorkin was fantastic. But when you've got a role like that, it's an important role in the show. It's meaningful, but it's also five or six episodes over the course of four seasons. And so when you're under contract for a role like that, does that prevent you from going and doing other work? Or how would they notify you that, hey, we're going to have scenes with you in three episodes. You better be back in Los Angeles for that. How does that work?
Well, you know, the truth of the matter is, you're not under contract. I was just hired episode to episode. And will you be available this day for this many days? And, you know, and I never knew how many episodes I was going to be in. I was in like 5 to 7 a year. And I was in it primarily as vice president for 4 years. And then when Aaron Sorkin and Tommy Schlamme left the show after 4 years, they wrote sort of my character into a crisis where he left office, so that when Jed Bartlett had an MS episode and couldn't be president, John Goodman, the Republican, took over. And it was a very good, dramatic sort of ending for them and a launch of the fifth season after they had gone. But it was sad, and I loved my time on that show. I could do, yeah, I did a lot of other things. And I got to tell you, it really revived my career at that point, because all of a sudden I'm on the most popular show on TV and I have a prominent part in it, even when I'm in it only a few episodes. When I was in it, I was in it. And holding my own with Jed Bartlett and, you know, John Spencer, Leo McCarey, and working with these fine actors, with this fine, fine writer and directing by Tommy Schlamme and others, it's one of the best jobs I think I've ever had, and some of the best work I've ever done.
You know, I thought of you as the John Hoynes, very serious character, and you've seen you doing comic and stuff. In looking through your credits, I figured I'd see, oh, I'm sure he's been on a Law and Order. I'm sure he was on an NYPD Blue. I'm sure he was on a Murder, She Wrote. That's not in there. And so was that something that you ever had any interest in? Because it seemed like there were a ton of actors that rode through those parts, but did those just, were they're missing? You were working other things at those times?
Yeah, there was a good 5-6 years where I was doing features and so I wasn't doing television. But, you know, I get offered things sometimes that I wouldn't do. And I guarantee you, when I was younger, I auditioned for a lot of shows that I didn't get. It was only, I guess, you know, toward my late 20s that I started getting offered shows without having to audition for episodic shows. Because somebody had seen another episode they liked that I did. I mean, you know, how I got into The Virginian, I think I was probably 19 or 20. I had done an episode of Adam 12, which was a cop show, and with Kent McCord I can't remember his name, Marty Milner. I was a Texas hippie who had dropped acid and stolen a horse and was going to ride back to Texas. And then I got arrested. And so my scenes were in the back seat, handcuffed in the back seat of the police car, driving around the back lot of Universal. And I was this crazy Texas hippie, and it was a fun part, and I had a good time with it. Well, the executives at Universal saw that and liked what I was doing. And they were starting a new episode, a series of a new year on The Virginian, and they needed a new character, a young, funky kind of cowboy, and they said, would you be interested to do this? And I said, yeah, and they put me under contract, and that's when I started sort of the Western period of my career.
I remember that episode. In fact, I was watching MeTV one weekend, and you were on an episode of Adam 12, and you were on a Leave It to Beaver on the same Sunday. And those were probably before residuals were even available for those shows, right?
No, I think residuals had just come in. I started acting in 61, 62. I think residuals began in 60. But, you know, they didn't amount to much at that point. But I'll tell you one time when I was dead broke and I didn't know where the next house payment, rent payment was going to come from, I went out to the mailbox and there was a check for, at the time, 1967, maybe 68. It was like, back for over $2,000. And I went, oh, it's like I hit the lottery. Oh, my God. And it was from all the cartoon shows that I had done at Hanna-Barbera in their first run, their first rerun. And it was like, then I realized all those actors that I was working with, they are so rich because they do hundreds of these shows. I had done, you know, scores of them, but they had do hundreds of them every year and had done so for years. So going to the mailbox was one of the best things in their life. But that's how an actor lived. I mean, I was dead broke. I was thinking, I got to go to the credit union and borrow $50. And there was this check, you know. And so I was very fortunate and lucky to be in this business and be lucky enough to get the work that I got.
Well, we've only scratched the surface of your terrific memoir, and there's stories in there about working with Chevy Chase, about all the Belushi stuff, anything you care to know about Tim's relationship with John Belushi that I'm sure you're asked about all the time, and just everything else in between. The book is called Damn Glad to Meet You, My 7 Decades in the Hollywood Trenches by Tim Matheson. The book's available everywhere. The cover is fantastic, by the way. It reminds me of the Animal House poster.
Same artist, Rick Mayerowitz.
All right, very well. But, Tim, just a fantastic read, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Brian, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
You'll be wearing rubber gloves.
Do you own rubber gloves?